Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. This is Nature's Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. I'm Ed Newcomer, your host, and today we have with us Cash Schrieffer, retired U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Special Agent, coming to us from his home in Louisiana. Cash, thanks for joining us.
Yes, great.
Cash and I actually worked together and not together at the same time. We were agents at the same time, but we didn't work in the same part of the country. So our experiences were very different. And I'm super excited to talk to him today about his experiences as a special agent with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service working in the southeastern part of the U.S. I love that you, so many of us after we retire, you know, we end up going back to our roots so many times, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I want to jump right in and ask you, because I know people who are listening and watching are going to be really curious about, you know, what does a special agent do? Your last field office was Monroe, Louisiana, right?
Actually, I had a little office right after that. The end of my career was New Orleans, Louisiana.
Oh, you actually went to New Orleans at the end.
I did. I got a promotion, went to New Orleans, and then I got diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, so I retired a little early.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yes, New Orleans.
Yeah, that's actually interesting because I think, you know, so you went from Monroe, which was a single agent duty station, right?
Yes. But when I was in New Orleans, it was actually me in the office and a wildlife inspector, and then later two wildlife inspectors.
Okay.
We were there mainly the port of New Orleans as both a seaport and, you know, of course, an airport. And we have, as you well know, most of our designated ports, as they're called, have a lot more wildlife imported than exported. And an exception to that would be New Orleans. Most of everything is leaving. Alligator hides and turtles, live turtles.
Mm. Yeah, you know, I've talked about this before, is that I think you retired in 2013, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I'm sure you saw the same thing that we saw when I was working in Los Angeles. In the earlier 2000s, what we saw was a lot of wildlife coming into the U.S. And then there was a change, and we started to see more and more wildlife headed out, particularly amphibians, turtles, reptiles, things like that, headed out to like Asia. Is that what you were experiencing there in New Orleans?
Well, just kind of, I mean, this is rule of thumb, but if it was a turtle and it was headed for Asia, It was to be eaten unless it went to Japan, pets. If it was going to Europe, it was pets, unless it was going to Belgium or France, because turtles are part of the diet.
Isn't that funny how you can kind of narrow down where and why a particular species of wildlife is being traded based on where it's going, right?
As you know, a lot of this use of wildlife is cultural.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's turtle soup has always been a big thing for French-speaking people, at least Louisiana, France, Belgium, and pets. You know, the Japanese, not everybody in the world has pets, but they do love their pets.
I think the pet trade in the exotic animals is also increasing in other parts of Asia, like China, South Korea, even in Vietnam now, as those economies are growing and people have more disposable income, they are turning to, so there's a threat now for these species leaving the U.S. going into them. Food trade as well as the pet trade all across Asia.
Yes.
So that's actually great that you worked in New Orleans at the end. And let me just explain to our listeners what a wildlife inspector is. So within the Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Law Enforcement, there are special agents who are the armed, sworn law enforcement officers who do investigations, make arrests. But there's also a uniformed branch of wildlife inspectors, and they act often just like a customs officer would. They're usually based at ports of entry, border points, airports, or seaports. They're uniformed officers, and they conduct inspections of people and parcels and mail going in and out of the country. Cash, you worked for a while in a single agent duty station where you're all by yourself, right?
I did. I worked a little over 25 years total before I retired, but almost 18 of that was in single agent duty station in Monroe, Louisiana, which is in northeast Louisiana near Arkansas.
I imagine that is, I never worked in a single agent station aside from being overseas for 5 years, but I imagine it's kind of nice because you're, you know, you determine what you're doing every day, but you also don't have a partner to work with regularly, do you?
That is true. But we, as you know, and I would say even in single duty stations or anywhere, I partnered up a lot with state officers, with what was known then as federal refuge officers, now wildlife officers, and the FBI, say whomever.
Right.
I mean, not routinely, but if I needed help, there were several sources I could depend on.
Right, for sure. I mean, most of the time we, you know, Fish and Wildlife Special Agents should always and usually do have a good relationship with their counterparts in the state wildlife agencies and work with them a lot. But when you need to, you also, of course, reach out to FBI or ATF or Secret Service or U.S. Marshals or whoever's available and handy and willing to help you if you need it, right?
Correct.
So tell us a little bit about, you know, one of the things that I think is so cool about being a special agent for Fish and Wildlife Service is that what you do and the things you work on vary so greatly depend on where you are in the country and what field office you're assigned to. And in the southeastern United States, I think a lot of people might say, well, why do we need a federal wildlife agent in Monroe, Louisiana? So tell us a little bit about what are the federal conservation issues going on in that part of the country, Louisiana, southeast?
Well, over the years, since even before I was hired, we've never had more, except for training purposes sometimes, more than one agent in North Louisiana. Two-thirds of our population are in the southern third of the state. But to put an agent in North Louisiana or closer to the Arkansas border, it fills a big gap because the other agents out in the area would be Little Rock, Arkansas, or in the northern part of Mississippi. And the thing is, type of cases I worked a lot on in Monroe is the Louisiana black bear is the only subspecies of American black bear that was ever listed as endangered or threatened. And in 1992, it was listed as threatened. And so that meant pretty much anywhere a Louisiana black bear was taken, we had jurisdiction, we had authority to investigate. Now we had federal refuges across the state, and anything, of course, killed there, we already had jurisdiction. Nothing, the bald eagle, I'm trying to remember, and I think it was still threatened possibly when I moved back to Louisiana, maybe even endangered.
Yep.
So anytime we had a bald eagle killed or anything to do with bald eagles, that was a high priority.
Yeah, especially because, you know, eagles for a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Special Agent are pretty important for a lot of reasons. Like, bald eagle, of course, was listed under the Endangered Species Act for many, many years, and it's one of the great success stories as far as recovery goes. But even now that it's not listed, of course, eagles are still protected by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, or the MBTA, which is a major law that the Fish and Wildlife Service enforces. And of course, there's also the eagle, the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. So there's a lot of laws that affect them.
Yeah, birds of prey, you and I know that even when the Migratory Bird Treaty Act took effect in 1918, it excluded raptors.
Right.
But in 1940, they listed in a separate act, the Bald Eagle Protection Act. In the early 60s, they added our only other eagle, the Golden Eagle. And even now, with the Bald Eagle off of the Endangered Species Act, it's still higher protection, higher penalty potential under the Eagle Protection Act for both bald and goldens.
Exactly.
So small, very narrowly defined act, but very important.
Exactly.
And arguably stricter requirements than even an Endangered Species Act.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Early in my career, it was very clear that agents prioritized eagle issues, you know, because weren't a lot of protections for them aside from the
federal. We were down, supposedly, I think the count down because of mainly DDT in Louisiana. We're down to like 11 nesting eagles in the state. And now we're up way over 300. And in time, we may catch Florida. But Florida and Louisiana are two big states, particularly for nesting bald eagles.
Right.
In the southeastern United States. All our wetlands. You'll never find an eagle too far from a wetland.
That's exactly
or water. Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and you mentioned DDT. DDT, of course, is a pesticide that was widely used in agriculture for a long time and took a while for us to discover that DDT causes basically it aggregates itself the higher it goes in the food chain. And by the time you get to the predatory birds, it's at high enough levels that it causes their eggs not to harden properly, and they end up accidentally crushing their own eggs, and they have very, very poor nest success.
Correct.
And on top of that, eagles, of course, build these huge nests in trees, and people are cutting the trees down all the time and destroying nests, which is also a violation of the law. So there's a lot of things that affect eagles or have affected them. So let's talk about the MBTA, or the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, because I know that in Louisiana, it's a very important part of what a special agent is involved in. You mentioned it's was enacted in 1918. It's an oldie. It's one of the oldest conservation laws in the United States. You know a lot about the history. Why was the MBTA enacted in the first place? What was the problem it addressed?
Well, earlier we had an act enacted in 1900 that we knew as the Lacey Act, pretty much governed in interstate commerce or illegal wildlife. But back then, that time, we had a lot of market hunting where you go to big cities and you could buy waterfowl, ducks, geese, in the open market. Their numbers were plummeting. And another thing, you had women's fashions back then. You were plumes, a lot of in their hats. They'd use egrets and heron plumes. And there's numbers of these wildlife that furnished us these carcasses and these feathers. The numbers started to really crash. So they tried at first to pass the migratory bird law based on interstate commerce. And it was looking like it was going to get shot down at the Supreme Court. So they decided to go with one of the other couple of methods to have federal jurisdiction and go with the Migratory Bird Treaty, which we signed. And it's so back long ago with Great Britain on behalf of Canada.
Right.
And later, Japan got added to it. Mexico got added to it. The Soviet Union, after they broke up, Russia acceded, agreed, we'll stay under the treaty. When that came in, you had a federal offense to help protect migratory birds. And when you started having the ability to take cases to federal court instead of your local courts, and there's politics at every level sometimes, but at local levels, when you're bringing in people in front of the judge, the DA that are relatives, you try to take, you know, the making it a federal offense really took a lot of the now processing and dismissals out of it. So it was a good move. I always liking that when he went to the Supreme Court, there was a case, a guy who was a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agent, Holland, and he called the Attorney General of Missouri, and it went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court on constitutionality. And Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote a decision 9-0 as constitutional. It was based on an international treaty. And so that set the stage of us to really started to crack down on this commercial activity with birds. And it's just a big market. You know, people loved waterfowl and you can raise them, but why not go out in the wild and kill some? And it's kind of hard to, you know, that's this whole idea of sport fishing and hunting, or even commercial fishing and hunting, whatever, is to make things sustainable. When everybody's just taking as many as they can because they can sell it, it can be a huge problem.
Yeah, and that's really, you know, that's one of the things special agents tend to focus on is not just illegal activity, but illegal activity that commercializes wildlife, because that really is the big threat to not just, you know, individual animals, but whole populations of animals. And that we learned 100 years ago with almost decimating our own waterfowl population just for the meat market. And then, like you said, you add on top of it the demand for ornamental feathers, you know, that went into people's hats and clothing at that time. All of the migratory birds were getting hit, not just the waterfowl, but as you said, the egrets.
All of them.
Yeah.
All of them. I mean, it would have been a migratory bird had it stayed alive, but the supposedly most numerous bird in North America, the passenger pigeon, disappeared, absolutely disappeared off the face of the earth.
That's a very good example of why, you know, these laws and the needed to be enforced to protect these birds. And I think the really interesting thing and the key word here is migratory, because these birds move, you know, thousands or even, you know, tens of thousands, I don't know, tens of thousands, but certainly thousands of miles twice a year when they migrate. A big impact on them in, say, in Louisiana could impact their nesting success up in Canada when they go up there in the summertime, you know?
Exactly. Unless you have a disease come into play,
yeah,
it's much harder. And out of Leopold, Professor Leopold from the early part of the 20th century, well known for pretty much creating the science of wildlife management, is that when you have a migratory population of anything, you destroy any area within that path of migration, you could greatly endanger or threaten those species. Where you take like deer, like in Louisiana, they don't migrate. They pretty much hang out in a small area.
Right.
But when suddenly you have waterfowl nesting in Canada and they go through northern United States, sometimes they don't. They go all the way to South America.
Mm-hmm.
And if at any point you damage or just flat out destroy their habitat, the populations can crash or disappear.
Right.
So there's, you know, this interest, and a lot of people don't realize that, well, hey, you know, Canada, our neighbor, Mexico, our neighbors, Japan out in the Pacific, the eastern part of what is now Russia, formerly Soviet Union. We have these mutual interests in protecting our wildlife.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the whole migratory scheme is interesting. I always try to remind my friends and family that, you know, when you see a hawk on a telephone pole in June, and then you see a hawk on that same telephone pole in December, it's probably not the same hawk. You know, it's probably the hawk you see in December is probably a hawk that spends its summers up in the Arctic. And the hawk you see in June is probably one that spent its time.
Yeah, there are a few like subpopulations of the various migratory birds, and just how many are there? 800 something species are listed on the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Over 95% of the species of birds that inhabit, wild birds that inhabit either Canada or the United States, is a migratory bird.
Right.
I know I used to like say Louisiana, or even this applied when I was in Texas, Oklahoma. Wood is not a migratory bird. Well, in Louisiana, turkey, wild turkey, then you have quail, wild white quail, European starling, and that's it. Yeah. Everything else is either a resident bird, like say the bobwhite, everything else migratory bird. All your songbirds, all your birds of prey, water birds, little bitty finches, a lot of birds.
Yeah, it's definitely easier to name the ones that are not listed than it is the ones that are listed.
It is.
Exactly.
Yeah, you got to be a real good bird to remember the list of all of them.
So why is Louisiana such an important place for migratory birds? You explained it to me once, and it's you have a great way of explaining why Louisiana is so critical for migratory birds, particularly waterfowl.
Well, the largest waterway, the largest river on the North American continent is the Mississippi River and all its tributaries. 31 states, all are part of 31 states and parts of two provinces of Canada drain eventually into the Mississippi River. And there's wetlands all along that drainage, but when you get on the coast, that's where you also add things like cypress swamps, also marsh, various types of marsh, fresh, salt marsh, and intermediate marsh or whatever. So it gets cold in the north. Birds are going to migrate wherever they are in the world to warmer areas, particularly in the fall and the winter. And that means all that the birds and the top area for nesting of waterfowl in America or Canada is North Central United States, Continental United States, and Canada. And those birds, almost every one of them leaves in the winter, and they work their way down to Louisiana. And a lot stay here because we have a lot of wetlands, but some even go further. And it's quite a trip these birds make every year.
Yeah, it is. It's crazy. Basically, Louisiana, I mean, has massive populations of protected waterfowl and non-waterfowl, migratory birds in general, right?
Yeah, we've been seeing some change in the last few years because of various agricultural situations, warming, various things. But overall, we still have a very high population of waterfowl at times and just other type of migratory birds. We have thousands and thousands of acres of bottomland hardwood, marsh, swamp. And we also have man-made wetlands in that every year you have about, I think the number is now up to like 300,000 acres of fallow rice fields are flooded to pond-raised crawfish.
Right.
Before about the 1960s, they were all caught in swampy areas. Now people actually flood out these rice fields they had just recently harvested and you have crawfish. I grew up on a farm where we had cattle, rice, crawfish. We had 180 acres of crawfish at the most. And for many years, we sometimes would catch over a ton on average per acre.
Wow.
And when I was a kid running traps for my dad, you know, the price was like 30, 40, 50 cents. Now we had a big drought here last year, and the price was up there like $15 a pound.
For crawfish.
So very important rotational crop for these farmers to not only just, you know, have their fields for grazing, for cattle, for rice production, but they can also catch crawfish. And it's part, that's another thing, part of the culture.
Yeah, know? Right.
People love to eat that, eat crawfish, little lobsters, freshwater.
Right. And, you know, we were back to the MBTA. We were talking about how that was enacted kind of to stop this widespread over utilization, this commercialization. But interestingly, commercialization of wildlife still occurs to this day. I know you know who this person is. We're going to do a whole episode on a guy named John Perry, who went by the nickname Dopey. I know you know who that is, going way back. But tell us about an agent you know, Fish and Wildlife agent you know more about than I do, a guy named, I think is Joe, is it Greco?
Joe Greco.
Greco.
Anthony Stefano was his real name. Mm. And he went frequently, his covert name was Joe Greco.
Okay.
He was actually an attorney, and he worked for us for a number of years, and he went to very prominent waterfowl spots throughout the country, Chesapeake Bay, coastal Texas, Louisiana, Central Valley of California. And he had various covers. The one he used here in Louisiana was he posed as a potato chip salesman. He'd go around selling. And, you know, to just fit in with the culture, he'd like, what do y'all like to do? And they'd ask him invariably, you know, do you like to eat ducks? Do you like to eat geese? Yes. Well, we'll sell you some. And so he made buys here. And anyway, they finally, after a number of years, it's time to what we call take the case down. It's time to, you know, serve some search warrants or arrest people. And it was about in Southwest Louisiana, I think it was numbers of about 70 or 80 people arrested for illegally selling waterfowl that had been illegal since 1918.
Right.
You know, it's not like this came out of the blue. Right. And anyway, they arrested quite a few people. Some were, at least in the Louisiana portion, were brought to court for initial appearance in Lake Charles, Louisiana, or Lafayette. And quite a few of the people went to jail. And it wasn't, you know, super long sentences, but when most wildlife cases in America, you violate the law, you pay a fine for minimal things.
Right.
But suddenly, you know, people are going to jail. And I was a boy in the 60s when this happened. And it's like, suddenly nobody would even think about selling waterfowl at all, wild waterfowl. So they broke it up. They broke it up. And you and I talked about it the other day.
Yeah.
Some type of activity, especially commercial activity, you just cannot slap a person on the wrist. You have to put them out of business or just cripple their business so much where it's a behavior modification. You know, we can't make anybody do anything, but not too many people want to spend their time in a federal lockup
for
a situation that they don't need to be. Well, even with migratory birds now not being allowed generally to speak commercialized, I mean, some of the feathers you can,
right?
Game birds for fly fishing and things like that. But there's still a lot of money in waterfowl hunting and dove hunting, and people lease their lands and all the clothing, the various brands of camouflage and shotguns and decoys and boats and motel rooms and camps and everything. So per se, we may not be selling feather plumes anymore or carcasses to eat, but the people are making money off the resource still in a different way.
Yeah. There's always somebody looking to game the system, right?
Exactly.
And you know, that case you just described is a classic example of how enforcement can actually make a big difference in protecting a whole species or a whole population of animals, because it does really deter people. The Migratory Bird Treaty Act is a wildlife law that actually has felony provisions in it. And the felony provisions kick in if you're selling or offering to sell migratory bird parts or birds. So That was a great case that you talked about.
Yes, it was.
And you know, you have, I think, one of the things I always admired about you as an agent is that, you know, a lot of times as agents, we get focused on catching the next bad guy. Who are we going to catch? Who are we going to arrest? You know, that's the stories that we tell to each other. But you always have viewed your responsibility as an enforcement officer, not just in catching people and arresting people, but in educating people. And I wonder if you could just talk about that a little bit on how you viewed your role as an agent in terms of not just your ability to, you know, make that case and hold people accountable with consequences in court with a conviction, but also just changing behavior by education. What do you think the role is of an agent in that regard? And I want to talk about specifically that case that you and I talked about a few days ago after that hurricane.
Yes. Well, state wildlife agencies that manage wildlife, and even our old agency, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they have information available about what regulations and rules are and statutes and everything. But that said, I mean, your job is to when you see violations, take people to court. However, if you can solve a situation with just information, everybody comes out better. Everybody comes out better. And we had a case back in Louisiana back in 2008. This was 3 years after Katrina hit New Orleans, but a hurricane came through in early September, and that was the height of the harvest season for several types of commodities, soybeans, corn, cotton. And we have in central Louisiana, back then it was like the largest single piece of property that was agricultural and where all these crops were planted. And it came through, devastated it. They're not going to harvest. But for the purpose of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act baiting regulation for game birds, you can hunt for waterfowl, ducks, geese, also sandhill crane, which is not waterfowl. It's much more restrictive rules and regulations than dove hunting. And so what these people could have done is they their crop was lost. They could just flood it up, or it was already flooded because of 20, 30 inch rain, hunt it like that. But they wanted to go ahead and knock it down, plow it, manipulate it. And the thought was to get ready for the next planting time, which is about a year away, less than a year. But anyway, so we told them, you know, like, look, you can't do this. Under the regulation, you can, we greatly encourage people to hunt over agriculture lands if they're not full agriculture, fake agriculture. So this crop that we even allow you, the regulation, to hunt it as it is and even flood it. But normally it would be harvested, and with the waste grain, the waterfowl come in there. So it's like they in this hunting area of 40,000 acres, they had 100 duck blinds they leased for $5,000 a blind. And so they were making, you know, pretty good money off of that too. And it's to educate some people, some of it's a little harder to educate them. So I the guy called me that was head of the hunting area, that area. And he says, what's the penalty if we hunt over this area? I say, well, it can be up to 6 months in jail or $15,000 or both if you hunt it, potentially. So I get a call back about half a week later. He said, well, that's a pretty big penalty. I said, well, I'm going to tell you about another one, that if you violate the baiting regulation, particularly placement of bait or anything in the baiting regulation, I said the penalty can go up to 1 year in jail and or $100,000 for an individual, or $200,000 for a corporation, or double the gross gain or double the gross loss, as you know, under Title 18. So I thought that's going to kind of get our message across. And then he calls again and he's agitating. I said, look, we got another law called the Lacey Act that has felony provisions that it forbids that you leave the knowing or sale of illegal wildlife, which this is. You've been told this is illegal, so this could be up to a 5-year felony for selling illegal guiding or outfitting services, selling illegal guiding or outfitting services. So then I got a call, which I wish that's the guy who would call me to start with, his attorney, And we just, you know, we go down to regulation. We agree. That's what it says. But it was like, you're not going to enforce that. I said, we've been enforcing it. Well, the baiting regulation started in the 30s after the act was passed in 1918. So yes, we're going to enforce it. And so in my only time in my career, they hired a pretty good attorney firm in Central Louisiana. They filed an injunction against us, against the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service, or the Fish and Wildlife Service and the director. So we had a hearing.
The injunction was to keep you from enforcing the law, right? Enforcing
the regulation.
Yeah.
But what we knew, not only did they have that conversation earlier with that particular area where they were hunting, I knew it was going to be a problem. So LSU, which is the Land Grant College of Louisiana, the Agriculture Authority, they put out a news release warning people or just educating people that hunt your field that's been destroyed by a hurricane, but don't go manipulate it or knock it or plow it down. So when we had that hearing in court, you know how when you're in court, you kind of tell it kind of sways back and forth. But it was looking good for us. But whenever I took the stand and the judge learned that we had gone the extra mile to notify not only these people, but people throughout the state. And it's like, look, beware. You know, this is a violation. That strengthened our hand considerably.
Excellent.
Because we were reasonable in our attempt to notify people of what the regulation was, what the penalty was, and why. I mean, this area there that they couldn't hunt, we would surveil it two or three times a week for the rest of the winter, and they would have at times 750,000 birds on it, ducks and or geese.
Wow.
That's pretty significant.
Yeah.
Including one of the three biggest areas for canvasback ducks, which is not a very common duck. Mm-hmm. And there's times in that area where something like 40% of all the canvasback in the world were in that area.
So there was a huge potential for massive take of waterfowl on this one property alone, right?
Yes. And even if people don't go over the limit, the regulations are set up, at least the biology behind all of it, is like if everybody that goes hunt gets the limit every day, the seasons wouldn't be as long.
Right.
I mean, there's some days it's not expected you to get a limit, but those birds are so plentiful, they were going to have some awfully good hunts, even if they never went over the limit.
Right. You know, there's so many interesting things about this story that I like, but I think, to be fair to listeners who are not Fish and Wildlife Service agents or state officers, I got to back up just a little bit. I'm going to try to explain. I'm going to explain this as if I was trying to explain it to my mom, and you correct me if I'm wrong. But basically what we're talking about here. So first of all, we've been talking about the MBTA, which prohibits the take or killing, whatever, capture of a migratory bird. But with regard to waterfowl and doves, and as you mentioned, sandhill cranes, there is some hunting allowed, and it's set through regulations. The federal government sets the regulation. And when they talk about limits, that's how many birds you could kill per day, per hunter during the hunting season. And so those federal regulations are set, and those are enforced by either Fish and Wildlife or state officers. So there's that. But what you're getting into is really interesting, because you're getting into the what's called the baiting regulations. And the federal regulations generally prohibit hunters from hunting over bait. And the reason for that is because obviously you get a lot of waterfowl congregating over seed or grain or whatever that's put out as bait. And you can kill, you know, in one day, you could kill hundreds of animals, or, you know, just take too many, basically. One more thing, gosh, I got to get it out of my head, and then you correct me if I'm wrong. So when a field is destroyed like that, that is not necessarily bait, but if you change it, if you manipulate that, you can then create a baited situation where you've got a baited field. Is that accurate?
That's very close. Yes, it's accurate.
As you can tell, I didn't work on a lot of waterfowl cases.
As you know, that regulation is not as easy to understand as hunting without a license.
No, not at all.
Yeah, and so, but that's true. That we some of the greatest waterfowl hunting is on farmland. And so we rely on these agriculture extension agencies to tell us what actually is legitimate form.
Right, right.
Practice. Because right. somebody could say, well, I'm planting rice in fall. Well, nobody plants rice in America, right in the late fall or the winter. And so it makes people stick with what is necessary to have a legitimate crop. And most people want to hunt, want to harvest and make money off the crop, but there's waste grain left over, yep. which attracts waterfowl. It's okay, we allow you to hunt, but you can't have fake agriculture,
right?
Generally speaking. But like the, you know, the easiest to understand is you can't go pour out of a bucket or a truck or whatever. I worked in Arkansas one time, they had a big fertilizer spreader and manure spreader, and they just would buy the sack, load the grain in there. And this is pre game cameras. And so two agents in Arkansas, I dropped them off for 4 days in a row. And what great video where this big truck with swamp tires just spreading tons of grain out all over this field. No wonder they had good hunts every day.
Yeah. So that's a good clarification. If it is a manipulation, it's got to be a legitimate agricultural purpose, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Correct. As you can tell, in when I was based in Los Angeles.
Some real technical things, but if it's a post-harvest manipulation, you can go, yeah, you can't manipulate prior a standing crop.
Right. As you can tell, working in Los Angeles, I didn't do a lot of waterfowl baiting cases, and they're complicated. They're very complicated. And I think it's why educating the public is so important. And funny enough, Cash, a story just from my career, one of the few times I ever thought a situation was going to turn violent was when me and two other agents were out in the El Centro Valley in Southern California. And we did just what you're talking about. We found a field that had been, I think it had been manipulated, if I remember correctly. We went and talked to the landowner, and we had told him you were not allowed to hunt that property, and you can't have any of your, you can't lease it out for hunting. And it, he became so angry. He was so angry. I thought he was going to be violent with us.
Yeah. I've seen some of that. We don't realize part of any kind of law enforcement job is to be also psychologist,
exactly.
Peacemaker.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I still don't quite know for sure why he backed down. Something happened in our interaction, and he was giving off all those signals that, you know, as law enforcement officers, we're trained to recognize as pre-assault indicators. And all of a sudden he just calm down. And I don't even really understand what happened in that relation, in that interaction, but he went from almost violent to calm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I always try to settle them down pretty quickly. Yeah. If it's just one person and it's one or more agents, then it's not as pressing. But when you have two or more subjects or their friends there, I've seen too many women in particular take their significant other, like, you're going to let this government man do this to you?
Exactly.
It's like, please, miss, please, sir. let's all keep this calm to where everybody goes away from here in one piece. We're undamaged. We're just here to do our thing, protect wildlife. And, you know, people just get upset.
Yep.
They get upset. And that's understandable. But when you start making those threats non-verbally or verbally, we don't want them to get hurt, and we certainly don't want to get hurt.
Exactly. I was on another podcast as a guest myself recently, and I was telling the story about Vic Blazevic, our agent who was shot in the line of duty. And he had been ambushed by duck hunters, which, you know, I think especially today with a lot of agents working on commercialization and international or interstate trafficking, you never know who's going to be dangerous. It might be that person who's just really mad at you because they can't hunt ducks today.
Correct. You never know. And I've seen people and known people that it's an addiction.
Yeah.
I mean, they had in Shreveport, Louisiana, one time a man came in and he was about ready to be sentenced to 6 months in jail for hunting. He had had a prior waterfowl violation. He had been put on probation and a fine, community service, but a special part of probation. You can't hunt anywhere in the world for 5 years. You can't go to a hunting camp. You can't be with hunters in the field. Well, he hunted and he got caught. And then we made a mistake, he got divorced not long after. And he just told his wife and back to the judge, I love duck hunting more than I even love my wife. Well, that's not a good thing to say to the judge, especially with your wife in the courtroom.
Definitely not.
Not at all. Temporary insanity. But anyway, but some people, that's their life.
Yeah.
I mean, so we think about golf, tennis, whatever. They want to go to the duck camp every day. Every day. Or the deer camp or whatever. That's their thing.
There's a something. Exactly. And that's true all across the U.S. There's a great case that one of our agents in Idaho did once, and the penalty included not only inability to hunt on federal land, but you couldn't even, the defendant during his probationary period, he couldn't even visit federal land. And, right. And, you know, Idaho is, there's a large percentage of Idaho is either U.S. Forest Service, BLM, you know, and this poor guy in Boise, really, that impacted his life.
Well, I Dave Hall, who you've heard of, yes. I don't know if you've ever met him.
Dave's a very famous fish and wildlife agent. Yeah.
Well, he's also was a master's graduate in wildlife management from Mississippi State University. He had a questionnaire that the professors did for him and asked four questions. How many times during the course of a year do you go over the limit on waterfowl
Interesting.
Or ducks? How many times you go over the limit on geese? Do you hunt over bait? Do you for geese? Do you not? And they already knew that all the people the questionnaire was sent to were hunters that had already been apprehended.
Okay.
And what do you think the penalty should be? And almost to a person, the worst thing was not serving time in jail. It was to be put on probation and have your hunting rights taken away.
Exactly.
Because, I mean, we have had some people go into clinical depression because they, you know, their life was around being at the camp since they were little children, and now you can't even go to the camp,
right?
Or with any hunter in the world,
yeah.
You don't have to put people in jail when you have penalties like that.
That's true. That's a good point. You know, sometimes we lament the fact that some of our penalties are fairly low under the federal sentencing guidelines, but there's a lot of things a judge can do to deliver consequences to somebody and change their behavior.
Yeah.
And somebody.
Preservation, more so non-game birds, and migratory birds can be divided non-game and game. And of course, ducks and geese and doves, game birds, very structured seasons. And certainly, we don't want the species to get threatened or endangered. But also, the whole sport of hunting is to evenly spread the resource. You know, you don't get to, because you have the great hunting spot, kill 100, 200 ducks or whatever. The limits are, you know, usually way below 10, 10 at the most for waterfowl. And that way you kill your share and your neighbor can maybe kill a few too. But when you get to, I want it all, you know, it's just not good for the species, not good for the whole idea of sport hunting.
Exactly.
So, yeah. Every regulation we have regarding migratory game birds is like limits take, you know, in some kind of way.
Yep.
Baiting rate. When the act passed in 1918, there were only two components. Either were a non-game bird where you couldn't hunt at all, or game bird, if it's a game bird, when the season was and what the limit was. Then later we realized by the 30s, and the country was in this deep drought all over, the numbers plummeted in waterfowl. That's when they came up with the Federal Duck Stamp, another act to support wetland purchase. And so you had all these people, you know, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And so they came up with things like baiting. You couldn't bait. You couldn't use shotguns with capable of holding more than three shells at one time.
Right.
And a few other regulations to restrict harvest a little further. Live decoys, that was passed then too. I mean, we got to do what we got to do to keep it to where we too much impact on the species. The whole idea is, you know, where the birds have enough numbers to reproduce and keep their numbers steady, or if they're down, bring them back. To hire them.
Exactly. So it's there for everybody.
Yes, everybody. And many people, there's more money in bird watching than there is in hunting.
Yes.
That's a economic boon to the country. Bird watchers.
That is wildlife. True. Wildlife watchers now, the money that they spend on doing that activity outstrips what hunters and fishermen spend on that activity. I always find that very interesting. Yes. You know, with regard to that case you just described with the hurricane, one of the things I love about it is so many people that we deal with in an enforcement capacity, as you know, when you arrest somebody or you give them a notice of violation or a citation, they often characterize us as overly aggressive or jackbooted thugs or, you know, very cold, mindless enforcement officers. But the example you gave there where, you know, you and I'm sure other agents went above and beyond to educate the violators, potential violators, before they became violators. Yes. I mean, it's such a great example of we are not out there just to put as many people in jail as we can or get as many people caught. We're trying to save the species. That's what we're trying to do.
We are. And I mean, like, information is always available.
Yeah.
Phone, internet, whatever, websites. And the thing about a hunter or a fisherman, especially if they've been out in a while, they know or should know the regulation.
Yeah.
I mean, there have been many people I apprehended on whatever hunting violation, and they would have the regulation with them, and I'd ask them, did you read this? Well, no. I said, well, how are you going to get me?
Exactly.
Or they didn't have it. And I says, you could have called me.
Exactly.
Call one of us and inquire. Or just load the gun and go.
Exactly. So listen, we're coming close to our end of time here, but before I let you go, I wanted to just ask you, you know, is there something, as you look back on your career, both as a federal agent and as a state officer, is there any one thing that kind of jumps out at you is that you're really proud of or really feel was a great accomplishment?
Well, I think that I had an advantage growing up on a farm where we were waterfowl, we were migratory bird hunters, and we had a lot of other migratory birds. And I did a lot of reading of Aldo Leopold and Muir, Thoreau. And I'd read Field and Stream or other outdoor Hook and Bullet magazines. And I'd read these stories of people that would obey the law.
Yeah.
And I thought it was fictional almost, because it's a problem that where there's an abundance, even a small fraction of people that are hunters or fishermen can destroy the resource.
Yeah.
They're just so greedy. And so I think these situations where we worked hard to apprehend these people, in particular, making a lot of money off of whatever they were doing illegally, or even just sport-wise. I mean, there's people that they don't know for whatever reason, it's their fault, they don't know, but people willfully, knowingly, we have this public trust over wildlife. And, you know, I had one billionaire I apprehended in my career, and that was like 30 plus years ago. And the talk is, well, if he couldn't get out of it, we, the common folk, what chance do we have?
Exactly.
So just the apprehended of that person and the successful prosecution and a good penalty changed other people's behavior.
Yeah. You make the right case, and you can deter future bad actors for sure.
It's not like we're picking on anybody, but we have to go where we can make the best effort for the resource.
100%.
The wildlife resource.
100%. Cash, thank you so much. Thank you so much for all of your service to the people of Louisiana and the United States. I really appreciate it. It was such a great honor to work with you as a colleague, and it's so great to have you on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. You're doing a good thing in your retirement, semi-retirement, and we love it.
All right. Fantastic, Cash. Thanks again for talking to us. And hopefully we'll have a chance to have you on again sometime. Nature's Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturessecretservice.com.